This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
When God began creating heaven and earth, the earth was void and desolate. There was darkness on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved over the face of the waters. Thus unfolds the most revolutionary as well as the most influential account of creation in the history of the human spirit. So begins the preface to the Koran Tanakh Magerman edition, this preface penned by the late Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks of blessed memory. A decade in development, the new Koran Tanakh offers an eloquent, faithful, and masterful translation of the Torah, prophets, and writings with the renowned Koran Hebrew text. Join us as we speak with Rabbi Reuven Ziegler, editor-in-chief, and Jessica Sacks, translation team manager and senior translator for the Koran Tanakh. You're listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Rabbi Reuven Ziegler is chairman of the editorial board at Koran Publishers Jerusalem, director of research at the Toras Horav Foundation, and founder and editor-in-chief of Yeshivat Haaretzion's renowned Israel Koshitsky Virtual Beit Midrash. Aside from numerous articles, he is the author of Majesty and Humility, The Thought of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Jessica Sacks, niece of Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, is senior translator for Koran Publishers.
Rabbi Reuven and Jessica, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Glad to be here.
Now, the first lines of the preface to the new Koran Tanakh reads, quote, "To undertake a new English translation requires chutzpah and humility in equal measure, but neither more than yirat shemayim, fear and trembling before God," end quote. Rabbi Reuven, as editor-in-chief, tell us about this Koran Tanakh Hebrew-English translation, about the work involved, and why another translation?
Well, that gets to the question of the chutzpah of undertaking a new translation. First of all, the process was nearly a decade, and it involved dozens of people from the translation team headed by Jessica to reviewing scholars, to footnote scholars, to literary editors. Jessica was also one of our two literary editors, and proofreaders and cartographers and design and typesetting. It was a huge, huge project. So it's a good question. Why undertake such a crazy thing, especially in something that's been translated not just once or twice, but dozens and dozens of times? So I think that we were trying to attain two goals. Jessica, you can feel free to add. We spent a lot of time, Jessica and I, and then obviously we consulted with Rabbi Sacks, just trying to define the goals. What are we trying to do here? So we wanted to present a faithful Orthodox Jewish perspective based both in the Jewish interpretive tradition, especially the tradition of the Pashtanim, of those who had a more literal contextual understanding, as opposed to those who were more homiletical, the Darshanim. And we, at the same time, wanted to be informed by all the findings of modern scholarship. So that was one goal. The second is that we wanted to produce something beautiful, not just beautiful in terms of the packaging and the design, but mainly a beautiful translation. And what you have in most Bible translations is they're translated by scholars. Scholars tend towards the literal, and the prose is often, and the poetry is often kind of clunky because they're trying to be very, very literal. We wanted something that would read beautifully. Like, even if you don't know the Hebrew, you could just read the English and the prose would be majestic and absorbing, and the poetry would be soaring and would be beautiful. So we did the opposite of what most translators do. We started off with a team headed by Jessica of experienced literary translators, all of whom were very knowledgeable in terms of their Judaic knowledge. And then they were guided by a team of scholars. In other words, their work was, they got a bibliography from our scholars to help prepare them. But they had free rein as literary translators to do the most beautiful job they could. And then the scholars, the reviewing scholars, came in and reined them in when they took too many liberties. And there was a very fruitful dialogue. It's not like the scholars sent in their comments and that was it. No, then there would be back and forth. There would be this ping pong going back and forth. And then when they would come to agreement, then the literary editor would step in. And then the literary editor and the scholar and the translator would have dialogue. In the end, a lot of the decisions were left to the translators because their name is on it. But still we could consult Rabbi Sachs, we could consult Rabbi Weinreb, who was also a consulting rabbinic scholar and a translator. You know, in terms of, I guess, in the world of Bible translation, they talk about formal versus functional equivalence, or you could say in layman's terms, you know, literal versus literary. So we definitely wanted to lean in the direction of the literary. And given these goals, you can understand why we needed chutzpah and humility and yirat shamayim. The chutzpah was exactly what you said. Why undertake such a huge project and why retranslate the book? So we had to have a little bit of chutzpah. We had to have a lot of humility because we had to try to absorb, you know, 3,000 years of Jewish interpretive tradition. We had to keep ourselves open to the truth that we can find within contemporary academic scholarship. And when you're translating what you view as, you know, when you're trying to be a conduit to bring the word of God to a new audience, you need a lot of humility to do that. And that connects to why we needed Yirat Shamayim. Why do we need to be God-fearing, given that we're an Orthodox Jewish publisher and we relate to the Bible as the word of God and, you know, words spoken with divine inspiration. So this is the highest of high stakes projects. You know, very often when we publish a lot of other books under our Magid imprint and other under our Toby imprint, and inevitably there will be a mistake in a book. So we say, okay, there's a mistake. It's not the Bible, but this time it actually was the Bible. So yeah. So we needed to have a lot of humility and fear of God.
And how many years did this take,
Jessica? What was it, about 8 years?
Oh well, we began working on it as a Tanakh project about 6 or 7 years ago, but parts of it had already been translated for the liturgical books we brought out. So altogether, 10 or 15.
Yeah.
The late Rabbi Jonathan Sachs of blessed memory provided the English translation for the Pentateuch as well as for many of the Psalms. Jessica, you were not only a translation team manager and senior translator, but Rabbi Sachs's niece. Would you tell us about Jonathan Sachs' life and legacy?
Yeah. Well, he grew up in, obviously I would think of it as a very average, normal English Jewish household, but I think one could call it a fairly average Anglo-Jewish household. That's to say that his parents did not have a huge amount of Jewish education, and that throughout their lives was a source of sadness for both of them. My grandfather had left school at 14 to go and work in the rag trade. He pursued his education as much as he could, you know, in the evenings and so on, and they placed a very high value on learning culture, and they really wanted their sons to go further, and they thankfully lived in a time where in England that was very possible, because you know, if a child had you know, natural ability and a lot of motivation and a family that was supporting his education, then the government provided a very good education. And so it was not an unusual story that this you know, East End Jew who was a economic refugee, I suppose, had four children and they all went to Cambridge and two of them studied philosophy. That was in itself not an unusual story for the time and the community, but his personal life path took a turn in, as he tells it, in 1967, that the Six-Day War broke out, and it was a very formative experience for him and a lot of his contemporaries who had, you know, always supported Israel, you know, had family, some family history actually in Israel and family in Israel, but and supported, you know, donated money to plant trees, but it was not something that they felt was going to direct their lives. And suddenly in 1967, this war broke out. These you know, huge armies were coming with the intent to drive Israel into the sea. And it took these English Jewish students by surprise, how this, you know, existential terror, you know, really caught them up in it. They were all going and praying, and it raised for him many questions about what this Jewish identity is that has so much deeper a hold on him than he had been aware. And that set him on his journey where he went to meet the sort of great rabbis of that time and really changed his life course and became a rabbi and became a trainer of rabbis and ultimately 1991, I think, became chief rabbi. And he was chief rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations, which is in England is very much the broad synagogue. I think this is different from the American Jewish community, where perhaps the default synagogue to go to will not be an Orthodox one particularly. But in England, your sort of local Orthodox synagogue is where you go, whether you're somebody with a, you know, a yeshiva, strong yeshiva education, is living a very Orthodox life, or whether you have a much more casual relationship with it, or come for different reasons and don't live such a you know, such a punctiliously religious life outside. So it's a very, very broad spectrum. But of course, you know, as I've described, that, you know, that extended family contains that whole spectrum. So he was not fazed by that, and he spoke to that whole broad audience, sort of never patronizing, never scolding, never trying to change people. But, you know, I think he very much believed that you don't go for the lowest common denominator, because what unites us is the highest, you know, the highest messages and questions of the Bible are really the ones that we all have to deal with across the Jewish world and other traditions, outside the traditions, you know, how to build a just society, how to live together with people who are different from us, how to build our personal relationships, our society relationships. So this was how he addressed the Jewish community. He had these weekly readings of the weekly scriptural reading of Parashat HaShavua. He would send out to very wide, you know, many, many people subscribe to his weekly writings, which would take, you know, maybe some subtlety in the text or some rabbinic question around the text, but which had showed how it addressed the fundamental questions that we all have in common, and bring it into conversation with philosophy, psychology, you know, economic theory, and always as Reuben described in this very, very beautiful, dignified, and also very clear language. And at the same time as addressing this wide Jewish audience, he was also being turned to outside the Jewish world, you know, and the BBC would broadcast, be asked to speak and address issues representing not just the Jewish tradition, but traditions and moral thought in general, because he was very, very strong believer in the importance of religion in general. And he wanted Jews to be proud Jews. He wanted Christians to be proud Christians, Muslims to be proud Muslims, and Sikhs to be proud Sikhs, because he really felt that this, you know, separately and together, we have a very important voice and role to play, which we need to sort of take ownership of and bring to the benefit of the world. So that was I think speaks of his project. You know, translation was a very small part of what he did from his point of view, I think, but it had a big importance for the people who use his translation and will use.
I had read recently in one of Rebbe Schneerson's biographies that the Rebbe had an influence on Jonathan Sacks. Was that so?
Yes, he cites the Rebbe as that major influence that really changed his course when he was a student traveling around America, meeting many rabbis. He also mentioned Rabbi Soloveitchik as a very influential one. But he tells of how he sat with the Rebbe and asked all his questions, and then the Rebbe started asking him questions. And what are you doing to enhance Jewish life in the place where you are? What are you doing? You know, this is what you must do. You know, I think he received his mission in a way from the Lubavitcher Rebbe.
So, what else makes this edition of the Tanakh special?
I'll get to that question in a second. I just want to add one point about Rabbi Sacks. He devoted about 5 years, which turned out unfortunately to be the last 5 years of his life, to working on this project. And he had invitations coming in from all over the world, you know, to speak, to be on, you know, committees and councils and advise. And he blocked off time to work on this. And I think one of the reasons it was so important to him, it may be obvious, let's say, to Christians that a religious philosophy should be derived from the Bible. But traditionally, if you look at most Jewish philosophers, they derive their philosophy mostly from rabbinic writings, from the Talmud, the Midrash, and later writings. In the past 200 years, there's been a return to regarding the Bible as a wellspring of Jewish thought. And to, if you see, for example, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, a lot of his thought really is biblically based. And Rabbi Sacks, it's very striking that he really is, he brings in obviously the Talmud and the Midrash and rabbinic writings, but he's very heavily based. Most of his deep philosophical discussions are constructed around a biblical narrative. And he really felt that that was what can speak to people today. It can be a source for Jewish philosophy. It can be a bridge between communities. And I think that's one of the reasons that he felt it was so important. He was so deeply connected to the Bible as a thinker that he was very committed to putting out this new edition. So not to get to your question, sorry about that. There's a lot of features in the new edition. I mean, it comes in different sizes, and it comes in three different editions: a Hebrew English, an English only, and then an expanded Hebrew English, which I'll speak about in a minute. That one hasn't gone to print yet. One of the things, so obviously the thing that we had to put the most effort into is the translation and getting that right. But we've spoken about that a little bit. Some of the other things, I mean, first of all, it's just beautiful in terms of just the layout, the fonts, the look of the page, you know, the binding, the covers, etc. The thumb tabs, like in a dictionary, you know, Jewish Bibles don't usually have that, but it's just, it's a useful thing. some of, we may recall what a dictionary is before you would go to dictionary.com. One of the features that I personally like the most about this, before I get to all the material in the back, we have appendices, which I'll speak about in a minute. And in the different editions, they're between 60 to 160 to 900 pages in the three different editions. But the layout of the English page, the Hebrew page traditionally has divisions, has line breaks in certain traditional places. But it's not the way we format things today. Like if you read a novel, you have paragraphs, you have dialogue form, as you know, dialogue appears in line by line. Poetry will appear with line breaks and stitches and indentations. And so just looking at a page of an English book, you see what's prose, what's dialogue, and what's poetry. So in the Hebrew English edition, if we didn't want it to be 3,000 pages, we had to keep, you know, it's 2,000 pages, 1,000 Hebrew, 1,000 English. And the English is formatted just like the Hebrew, with large blocks of text with the traditional breaks. But in the English only, and in the expanded four-volume edition, we formatted it like a contemporary book, with paragraphs and dialogue and poetry. And that in itself makes it so much more accessible. In terms of the material in the back, Koren's been putting out Tanakhs for 60 years. Actually, this is the 60th anniversary, 1962, the first Koren Tanakh came out. So 2022, we're going to have lots of events celebrating 60 years of the Koren Tanakh, which was really groundbreaking in many ways. And over the past 60 years, we've developed a lot of supplementary material. And so we, for these editions, we could draw on 60 years of material that we already had, in addition to new material that we commissioned. So there's at the beginning of each book of the Bible, there's a timeline which shows you where this book fits in the broader picture of the Bible. There's a subject division, you know, chapters this through this are about A, or it happens at this point. This takes, you know, this takes place for 7 years, this takes place for 20 years, etc. So that's just very helpful. There are very short notes to help explain things that won't be obvious from the text. Like, I don't know, if someone's naming a child and therefore she named him Simeon because God has heard me. So, you know, that doesn't make sense in English. So we have a note explaining the derivation in Hebrew. We also have in the back maps, genealogies, charts, layout of the tabernacle of the temple, pictures of the priestly garments and you know, flora, fauna, archaeological discoveries, et cetera, et cetera. Now, so as I said, the Hebrew English edition has 60 pages of supplementary material in the back in full color. The English only, which is about to come out, has 160 pages of material. And then we're putting out what we call the Hadar edition, which I think will only be in the large size. It's going to be three volumes, English, Hebrew. One for the Torah, the prophets, and the writings. That's the traditional Jewish division of the Tanakh. And then the fourth volume is over 900 pages of supplementary material, which is really a guidebook to the connection between the Bible and the land of Israel. And there is just unbelievable amounts of material that, you know, can guide you through, let's say, biblical tours through Israel, routes that you can take, what you'll see, you know, what's the archaeological findings, what's the biblical place, where is it today? Just basically any question you could ask is pretty much answered there. So that's going to be an amazing edition. The Hebrew version of that is about to come out. I actually got an early copy today. Right behind me on that desk, and my family was just oohing and aahing over it right before we started speaking.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
How about we look at some examples of the English translation? Perhaps beginning with you, Jessica, would you tell us about one passage that is particularly dear or memorable to you?
It's a difficult selection. I'd like to add something to what Reuven said at the beginning when we were talking about chutzpah and humility. It's because, you know, the fear and the chutzpah come back to me every time I come to talk about translation choices and so on. I wanted to add a word about the tradition that we are part of, because the history of scriptural translation is extremely fraught in the church for very, very understandable reasons. But I think it's important to say that the history of synagogue translation, which is what we're joining, is a little different and probably a sort of quieter history that goes right back to the beginning of the synagogue and certainly the early days of the synagogue, and sort of the first century in the land of Israel when Hebrew was still an active language in different contexts, but when not everybody in the synagogue could understand scriptural reading, there from that early beginning, there was almost a simultaneous translation going on in the synagogue, where the scriptural portion would be read, the reader would stop at the end of the verse, and somebody would stand up and improvise an explanatory Aramaic translation so that everybody was accessing it. And not many, there are communities that preserve that tradition, not many. But that sort of essential situation whereby the Hebrew is always present in front of us and we're always using it. And in every Orthodox synagogue around the world, the Hebrew text is being used in the reading and in the prayer, and access to Hebrew education is one of the, you know, the obligations of the community to provide. So the translation is always there, but it never replaces the Hebrew. It's never what we produce at Koren, the facing page editions that Reuven was describing, where you've got the Hebrew text there, and that's what's being used publicly in the synagogue. And next to it is a translation that is every person is using as they see fit to access the Hebrew. That's the tradition that we're joining. In a way, it makes it less contentious and difficult for us. There's no authority questions here. We're not standing in the way of the Hebrew, and we have a lot of very educated, engaged readers who will confront us and question us and complain to us and question our translations, which is a joy. At the same time, we belong to a tradition, and this is, again, I think this is something that all Jews can agree on. While we can't agree in any given passage on how it is to be understood, it's absolutely fundamental that we all agree that it bears multiple understandings, multiple interpretations. That's fundamental to every sermon, that the text can be interpreted more than one way. So we, you know, many of our readers will not be engaging in that way, a critical way. They won't be pulling apart the translation. We were translating more thinking of the sort of, in inverted commas, the innocent reader who is reading the translation straight as it comes to try and access the text and experience the text, not thinking too critically. But they're not naive. They know that we are one of many. They know that any given interpretation that we've put down here is one of many, and we are adding. So that's what gives us, I suppose, the chutzpah and the courage, because it coming from that tradition of multiple readings and of always looking for more understandings. You know, as a translator, you have to sit down and try and say, what is the truest interpretation of this text? So we try and do that, but we would express it as, you know, what is closest to the simple meaning of this text? But we come from a tradition that is always looking for more, always looking, and it can be tortuous as a translator to choose a word, knowing that by choosing this, I'm excluding so many others that I could have chosen. And what enables us to do that is that we know we're not excluding them. They're still there on the shelf. They're still there to be discovered by other people. And so we come to it to try and contribute what we've got as part of a tradition that is always adding to itself. So that's by way of apology before I answer your question. I think that all of us were very, very immersed in the books that we were translating. They were very alive for all of us. And I think one of the things that Reuben tried to do was not only choose the right translator, but choose the right translator for each book. So we were each, you know, we were very, very engaged with what we were doing. But I my mind went to the Song of Songs, which is one of the earliest books I translated. Again, as an Orthodox community, we have a certain, there's a certain anxiety around the Song of Songs, and often we privilege or have privileged the allegorical readings, and there are even biblical translations there that don't give a straight translation of the Song of Songs. They only give an allegorical interpretation. And it was very, very clear to us from the start that we were not going that way. Even the medieval commentators who will always translate allegorically, they're clearly engaging with the simple text, the plain text, because the power of the allegory comes from the plain text. You know, there is no, you know, so it was clear to us, not only are we going to translate it straight as it is, as a set of love songs, but we're going to translate it with as much as we can convey of the beauty of it and the lyricism and the passion, you know, within, you know, while trying to with the modesty that is required of us and all of this. So my mind went to a small example, which is an example of, you know, discussion of one letter. There's I'll read the text, chapter 8, verse 6. Simeni chachotam alibecha, kachotam al zo'echa, which the plainest translation would be, place me like a seal on your heart, like a seal on your arm. Now, as Orthodox Jews reading this, the mind immediately goes to Deuteronomy 6, which we read every day in the Shema. It says, let these words be upon your heart. And then it goes on and it says, bind them as a sign upon your hand, have them as an emblem between your eyes, as we've translated it. And in practice, you know, as I say, we say it every day and we practice it, and the men wear phylacteries, which is how we understand that text in Deuteronomy. So having me on your heart and on your arm, to my mind, immediately takes me there to the phylacteries, to the tefillin. I cannot say with any certainty that that is the intention of the text there in its original, the original intention of the text. You know, I the words are not the same words, arm, hand. So I can't say that with certainty. We have evidence of very, very, that it's a very, very early practice to wear phylactery is very similar to what Reuben wears today. But I can't say with certainty that that's for the text. So I, as a translator, I've got to decide now, am I going to translate this absolutely straight without intervening? In which case the possible reference there will be diluted, because the when you read the Hebrew text as you're conversant with it, the references are constantly alive. The cross-biblical references are constantly active in your mind. In English, you know, English, there's much more English, and it is diluted down. Those references are diluted. So my fear is I can translate it absolutely straight without pushing the text in any direction, and then that avenue will be lost. Or I can push it a little bit further and risk putting something in there that isn't there. Now, usually we would take the first option because we don't have that much chutzpah. We don't want to add, you know, we want to leave that to footnotes and commentaries and study. So this was an example of an unusual example of a sort of a conscious, you know, as I was struggling with this text, a conscious sort of intrusion of life into the work, because, you know, a brave decision had been made to have as a translator for this text, you know, a young, at the time, unmarried woman. I mean, relatively young, not young to be an unmarried woman in the Orthodox world, but it was a brave choice on the part of Matthew Miller. And I was sitting, you know, somebody quite close to the perspective of this voice, which is, you know, of a young woman. And I felt my hardship and the hardship of my, you know, fellow travelers in this world and on this search. You know, the phylacteries, the tefillin today in Orthodox life, they very much belong to the ritual side, the unheroic side of religious life. You get up in the morning and get up early, and there's this list of things you have to do before you have breakfast. It's not very heroic. It's not very, you know, it's this sort of, in the Orthodox world, the tefillin are quite a male symbol, but it doesn't have that machismo, shall we say. And there was a part of me that wanted for my, you know, my friends along the way, I wanted to show them that this young female poet thousands of years ago saw their ritual and saw the passion in it, to the extent that when she addressed her beloved, she said, you know, apply, this is the passion that I want you to show me. And as we read it allegorically, we read it back the other way, you know, this passion that they have for one another is the passion that we're expected to turn towards God through ritual. And I didn't want that to be lost. So that's in that case, you know, it's a question, you know, we struggle over the difference between the word A and the word the. And this time I let the the win. So I translated, set me like a seal upon your heart, like the seal upon your arm. For love is as powerful as death itself, and jealousy unyielding as Sheol. It burns with sparks of fire, with the Lord's own flame. Great waters cannot quench love, nor torrents sweep it by.
Wow, that was beautiful. Well, Reuven, you have a tough act to follow now.
Very hard act. So fortunately for me, I'm not going to talk about something I translated, because I wasn't one of the translators. Jessica was. And so you can see the amount of thought and passion and vision that went in, and religious inspiration that went in to, you know, a seal upon your arm, or the seal upon your arm. So so I'm going to talk about something that Rebbe Sachs translated. One of the interesting things was, you know, when you're translating, as Jessica said, there's in any translation, there's more than one correct way to translate. In the Jewish interpretation, there was a professor, Yaakov Ellman, who coined the term, I think he coined it, omnisignificance, that, you know, every word has infinite meaning within it, and that the goal of interpretation is often not to find the correct interpretation, but all the potential interpretations. And but when you're translating, you know, you have to choose one. And so how are you going to choose it? So our translators kept notes that weren't meant for publication. They were meant for the next people in the stages, the literary editors, the scholarly editors, to justify their decisions, to say, you know, I'm aware that this can be translated the following way, but I chose to translate it this way for the following reasons. And Rabbi Sachs also left some notes like that, you know, that to show that he was aware of the other possibilities. So one of them is in a very interesting one, which shows the kinds of choices he was making, is in Exodus chapter 1, verse 15. Pharaoh commands the midwives to kill the Jewish boys who are born, and they disobey. Now, the term in Hebrew is, let me find it, Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim Lamialdot HaIvriot. So the king of Egypt told the Mialdot HaIvriot. Now, Mialdot means midwives, and Ivriot means Hebrew. But what are the connecting words? So there are two ways to understand it. One is he told the Hebrew midwives, or he told the midwives of the Hebrews. Well, what's the difference? According to the first interpretation, the midwives were themselves Jewish or Hebrew, Israelite. Jewish is a little bit of an anachronistic term. And that's the interpretation that appears in the Talmud. That's the interpretation that appears in the majority of Jewish interpreters. In fact, there's a Midrashic tradition that these two midwives, Shifra and Pua, were really Yocheved and Miriam. Yocheved, the mother of Moses, and Miriam, the sister of Moses. So if they're Jewish midwives or Hebrew midwives, it's understandable why they disobeyed Pharaoh. It's not so understandable why Pharaoh would expect them to do this. So there's a minority opinion within the Jewish tradition, and Rabbi Sachs quoted here four different opinions, four different people who supported it, that they were the midwives of the Hebrews, and they themselves were not Hebrews, which makes sense that Pharaoh would ask Egyptian midwives to kill the Hebrew babies. And so Rabbi Sachs quotes in his footnote that he's following the minority opinion, which I think first appears in Josephus, who's first century interpreter. And then the most famous proponent of it is the Abarbanel, who is 15th century, Spain, Italy, Portugal. He moved around, unfortunately. He was thrown out of, you know, this is the time of the Spanish expulsion. But he was one of the great Jewish biblical interpreters of all time. And he also quotes two 19th century interpreters, Malbim and Shaddal. Malbim from Eastern Europe, Shaddal from Italy. All of them adopted this minority opinion, and they adopted it on linguistic grounds. And Rabbi Sachs, I think, preferred this one, not on linguistic grounds, but on moral grounds. He wanted to show that, you know, for Hebrew midwives to disobey makes sense. But for Egyptian midwives to disobey shows that just like the daughter of Pharaoh, who wasn't Jewish, was involved in the salvation of the Jewish people because she was a moral person and found a baby and saved him and raised him. And she probably had an idea of who he really was. I mean, she called a Hebrew nursemaid to nurse the baby, who turned out to be his mother. But so he wanted to say that, you know, whereas, you know, maybe holiness is not expected of everyone, but morality, basic morality, is expected of everyone. And these two midwives were the first example of civil disobedience that we find in the Bible. I mean, Pharaoh, I don't think we have an equivalent today of an all-powerful autocrat like Pharaoh. I don't, maybe North Korea, I don't know. But Pharaoh tells you to do something and they disobeyed because they feared God. That's what the Bible says. They feared God. And what does fearing God mean? It means that they were moral human beings. That's what God-fearingness means in that context. So Rabbi Sachs, he had to choose one of the two interpretations. He was aware of both, and he chose the minority interpretation because it was important. It's an important message for today and what's expected of everyone.
This fine edition of the Tanakh is also called the Magerman edition. Would you explain that label for us?
Sorry, yeah. It required chutzpah and humility on our part, but it required a kind of madness and devotion on the part of the donors who sponsored this edition, David and Deborah Magerman, who I believe they're from Philadelphia in the States. And they were really taken by this vision. You know, our publisher, Matthew Miller, met with them and said, we want to undertake a very ambitious and perhaps foolhardy undertaking, but we have Rabbi Sachs on board, and these are the reasons we want to do it. And it's going to be a huge project, as it turned out to be. And we want to do it to the highest possible standards, which means we want to hire the best people, have a big staff, don't skimp on anything. And they said, okay, we're with you. We're going to underwrite this. So we have a lot to thank them for.
All right, so where can listeners get this Tanakh?
The easiest place is go to Corin's website, corinpub.com. If we have that, that's, you know, a worldwide website. If you're in Israel, you can go to corinpub.co.il. But that's the easiest place to buy it. It's also available in bookstores. It's available, you know, on that big website that sells a lot of things, which we won't name. Yeah, it's widely available. It's right now the Hebrew English edition is what's available. Very soon, the English only edition will be available, and going to print in the summer will be that mega 4-volume edition that I was speaking about before.
Ruvain and Jessica, thank you so much for being with us on the show. It was a delight getting to know you and hearing about the Koran Tanakh.
Thanks
for having us.
Friends, you've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.